Now on your food.
You go ahead.
Okay, I've got the brown tape. We can start. This is Paul Rodell, IVS Oral History Project. It is September 8th. I'm in the backyard porch in Chicago of Gene Stolzfus. Is that close enough to pronounce?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm doing this interview while he's having his couscous. Gene was in Vietnam from 1963 through 1967, starting off in Hamlet education, then becoming a team leader, finally one of the associate chiefs of party. I think it was in the second region, or two corps to follow the military style. And then was part of the foursome who resigned in 67 and has remained with IBS ever since, and currently still on the board and all of that. So perhaps we won't cover a lot of the contemporary things, but because that's quite beyond the study, in a sense. But getting toward the study, and as I've mentioned in just about every interview that I've had, that I've always said before, before I turned on the tape, I explained the first question, because I didn't want to, you know, actually do a first question without people knowing that it was coming, because they would have thought that we're only doing the Vietnam years and not the background stuff. But we are interested in the background stuff. So something about when and where you were born and who your parents were, not just their names, but, you know, who they were as people in the community and in your family and your life, and all of the influences that you were subjected to make you the young Gene that was attracted to IVS and service in Vietnam. And now maybe I'll load up on the couscous.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Aurora, Ohio, which
really?
Is southeast of Cleveland, about 10 miles north of Kent.
Oh, okay.
And I grew up in a Mennonite community. My father was the minister and a bishop, and he was also a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the youngest of seven children. And as I grew up,
the seventh son?
No, not quite that. As I grew up, my older brothers and sister were, for example, one brother was off on a cattle ship to take cattle to Poland several times when I was really young. And
mm-hmm.
Another one was off on various sorts of peace missions immediately after World War II.
Oh.
And still another one was in certain kind of alternate service, actually in Vietnam. And
with
our home,
the MCC?
Yeah. And our home had lots of people through it, almost constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of grew up in an environment where mission and service work was very, very highly regarded and respected.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked those people. I liked to learn from them. I liked to hear the stories. And I actually felt somewhat confined if I didn't have some of that stuff around me.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And I went to local schools there, and then I went to Eastern Mennonite High School in Virginia for a couple of years. Graduated.
Eastern Mennonite High School.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Which is now called, I guess it's a different institution, but it's now, there's an Eastern Mennonite College, which is now called Eastern Mennonite University.
Oh.
And uh-huh. I went there for a couple of years of college, and then I transferred to Goshen. And finished college at Goshen and also took a year of seminary. I actually did almost 2 years before I went into IVS.
Uh-huh.
And I I went into, I could have gone into MCC at the same time. I went into IVS because I wanted a bit more of a diverse experience, I think, than a church program at that time.
What do you mean by, what kind of diversity?
Well, I just wanted a little bit more of a pluralistic experience than one would find in a church.
So people who wouldn't also be Mennonites.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Not actually the people that you'd interact with when you go overseas, because they would be the same.
That's right. But that's what I wanted to, I wanted to push out the boundaries of my life and yeah. experience.
Okay. And that's what I assumed.
Yeah. This was 1963. Civil rights movement was just getting moving.
Uh-huh.
At that time, I was not an activist.
Mm-hmm.
I was politically not terribly involved.
Well, how old were you by then?
By then, I was 23.
Yeah. So you were born in like 41.
I mean, I was born in 1940.
40. So, you know, by then, not how many people are political activists.
I mean, I was a child of the
1950s. Yeah.
Just remember that. And
of the 50s, and still only in your 20s.
That's right. So, in late June '63, I got on a train and went to Washington.
Uh-huh.
And became a part of this IVS training.
Was there any interest in going to IVS or MCC for alternate service?
Yeah, I was actually, this was an alternate service.
Okay, so that
assignment
was part of
for me.
Yeah.
Although that was not a determining factor for me in going into IVS. In other words, the decision to go into IVS or something like it
mm-hmm.
was a decision that took place, and then I tried to figure it out how it could be an alternative service.
Oh, okay. All
understand?
Right. Yeah.
So I knew I was going down this road.
Mm-hmm.
And the alternate service
could work for you as well.
I could make it work for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I've seen other people who got a CO status and then had to find some way to perform their service and then found IVS. So in your case, it was the opposite.
It was very much.
You knew the organization. You'd heard of it. You sought it out.
That's right.
And then you said, "Oh, Sonia Henny's Tutu. I can make this work for me." You know, mm-hmm. Okay.
So in brief, at least that's my background. I didn't return to seminary until 1973.
Uh-huh.
Ten years later, after almost 5 years in Vietnam and 5 years in D.C.
Oh, wow.
I always see Vietnam as the first career of my
mm-hmm.
life. It was really took up, that whole period took up Vietnam. I wasn't in Vietnam, but I mean, I was
for
working.
The whole thing, yeah.
But I was working in the peace movement after leaving Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where I come from. My earliest childhood was during the World War II.
Yeah.
And we were a pacifist family.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced when I started school some snarly treatment from others in the community because of that position. Not a lot, but some.
Even in the Mennonite community.
Well, it wasn't from the Mennonites, it was from others.
Yeah, well, I mean, they should have known better. They
yeah,
knew
I mean,
enough Mennonites.
It was like, you know, anti-Semitism or
that's right.
whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It was not patriotic, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, one of my first acts in terms of peace work was in the summer of 1945. I still remember being sent from the house out to the fields or the barn by my mother to tell Dad that it had been announced that the war was over, the armistice had been signed.
Uh-huh.
And I was very conscious of the fact that I was carrying an important message.
Even as a little 5-year-old.
Yeah. In Vietnam, I always had an enormous amount of support from my family and encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
Both in the early period of work with IBS and then later in the more public period,
mm-hmm.
When I spoke out and did a lot of speaking and organizing on the war situation. And, you know, our family would not have been heavily involved in American or local politics, so this was a bit of a new thing, but my family was very supportive. It's not like the experience of many others. I mean, this was a new kind of development in terms of our own growth. But I have always appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
Since you asked about my family background and the sort of the stuff of support, and I think that was also true of the academic world and the friendship milieu that out of which I sprang at Goshen College and the professors and so forth.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So all of that was a very important kind of, I felt an important and a very helpful support structure.
Yeah.
Particularly during those very polarizing periods and those times when we were, 1968, when we got back, did a lot of TV work and so forth. We were called some pretty nasty names sometimes, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And, so, I mean, I can still remember my first TV interviews. I was scared. And, I mean, I was learning, you know. It took me years to learn that I answer the question I want to answer, not the question that I get asked. But
don't you watch Politicians?
Yes, I do, but I didn't know that then. So... anyway,
you ask them which way's up, and they tell you about a tax return. You know,
that's right. You know? Yeah. So, in brief, at least that's my background.
Yeah. Well, that's a very concise and pointed, you know, in a very mm-hmm. positive and I think helpful way to clarify.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably going to make like checklists of, you know, how many people are this or that mm-hmm. and the other thing, and that nails it down very concisely and very clearly. Mm-hmm. Could you describe, let's see, this is 63 now, some of the training that you had, the orientation, the training and language and stuff like that IVS was giving to their volunteers at that time? And
yeah, there was an orientation in Washington, I believe it was 10 days, and as I recall, was it at Georgetown or George Washington University, maybe we had some rooms, and I remember Chan Van Zing,
mm-hmm.
the last who later became the last South Vietnamese ambassador. No, not the last one. He was the one that was fired. Anyway, I knew him through the years.
Uh-huh.
He was there, and the Lao people were there, and there were others, but I don't remember much about it.
Yeah,
I just remember thinking, wow, this is. There's all kinds of interesting stuff, and I didn't lose my enthusiasm at all. I liked the people
uh-huh.
I met. We flew to Saigon.
Who was this we?
Well, it was Willie Myers, there was John Summer, there was Pete Hunting,
uh-huh.
there was Carly.
Oh, Carly.
And I'd have to look back.
Carly, what is it, Allender or something?
Yeah, Callender, Carly Allender.
Okay.
And there were probably another. There were several who went on to Cambodia from that group, mm-hmm. and a couple that went on to Laos from that group.
Well, yeah, but those you wouldn't necessarily remember.
I believe there was maybe 15 of us or so.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Good time.
It's a very good group of people.
Yeah, oh, it was a good group.
Yeah.
At that time, I didn't know how good it was, you know.
Yeah, well, now I know, because I've seen every one of them that you mentioned.
I mean, they're
except
all
the sexual course
extremely time, competent and much more competent than I am. It was an enormous privilege to be a part of that group, and
they about you too.
Well, that's interesting. But I mean,
true.
I mean, they were that group of people in the early period In Vietnam, the stuff doing, working together with Don and so forth, I mean, they were the most important, that was the most important influence on my life.
Uh-huh.
They gave me the, that's where I developed.
Yes, you know?
That's where I became a man.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I believe we arrived in Saigon, I think it was the 4th or 5th of July. Was it the 4th? Did John Summer, he's much more careful about this. I think it was the 4th of July.
I don't know if he actually mentioned this precise date.
Oh, it was
date.
So spacey, because I remember we stopped overnight in Hong Kong, and I was all messed up time-wise. And I recall it was raining, you know, like it can only rain in Saigon. It was pouring down rain, and they were trying to figure out where they were going to take us, what they were going to do with us. If I'm not mistaken, they took us that same day that we arrived down to My Tha.
Uh-huh.
And that's where we did our training. And we studied Vietnamese for 6-7 weeks. This is the part that scared me the most, because I'd taken German in college. I was a terrible student. So I assumed that I was not a terribly good language student.
Uh-huh.
And I was determined that I was going to get this. And
then you had tones as well as vocabulary.
But the language training was just terrific. We had a great time. The first Sunday we were there, I remember walking down to the athletic field, and there were Vietnamese soldiers who were being helicoptered in. They were bloody, they were wounded. Oh. And years later I learned those were some of the early key battles that the U.S. was trying to engineer.
Uh-huh.
This
had been July of 63.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So Diem is still in power.
That's right. Diem is still, and we were reading the Saigon, was it Saigon Times? You know, it's terrible. I had all of those for a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
For several years I kept them, and then I just got tired lugging them around. They would have been very useful. Anyway, I did fair in language training. I wasn't the most distinguished student, but it was a good experience, and it was a good time. And I was assigned to Suan Lap.
Who was your language teacher?
Oh, Kui.
Okay.
There was a Kui, and I think there were a couple others too. And he was a teacher, as I recall, at maybe the National, the Normal School or someplace. And he was unrelenting and putting us through these paces and chow, wum, joy come, and so on and so forth. And I had enough. And then I was sent out to Suan Lap, to this Hamlet Education Project. That time, that project hadn't done anything, you know. I mean, it was just getting started. So we had a car, a green, I remember I was assigned a green Jeep. And I was assigned to stay at the agricultural experiment station. It was between Ben Hoa and Suan Lap. Are you familiar with where that is?
Yeah, generally.
Some of the last great battles of the war took place right there. And it's nestled in the general area where some of the rubber plantations are. And I have to check the map again, but it was very close to where the road would divide, one of which would go up to Suan Lap and then Phan Thiet and on up to Nha Trang, and then the other road would go up towards the highlands towards the Lot.
Oh, okay, all right.
And was sort of in that area.
Yeah.
I just go over a couple high points, which, and a lot of things that we could talk about, but a couple high points for me out there. I was assigned with Kruger. Bill Kruger? He was something ag. And he was assigned to that experiment station, whereas I was assigned to the education.
The Hamlet thing. The
Hamlet education office mm-hmm. in Schönlauk, which was probably 20 kilometers away. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of stuck out in the country there. And very early in our experience there.
Joe Kriegel, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What are his years?
I could look that up. I was just looking up the address, but Kriegel, come on, where are you? 64 to 66?
No, it's a different one. Because he would have been there in 63. Kruger. I think it was Kruger, wasn't it? Kruger?
Well, there's a, let's see, no, that one's earlier.
Come on, I can't get it. I haven't thought about him for a long time.
No, that's later. Let me pause this while I...
I'm sure it was Bill pull, Kruger.
I'll put this back on.
I really think it was Kruger, K-R-U-G-E-R. I think that's what his name was. Maybe it's not on the list. Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway.
Is that on now?
It's on. I just...
Okay. Well, I'm just sort of touching on stuff. You know, events... It was just... What were the dates when Zim was killed? Was it in...
November.
It was in November. Okay, so I would have been there only from mid to late August.
Right, because you had
November,
the language training.
And Zim was killed November what?
Oh, the precise date. Well, let's see. When was Kennedy killed?
That's good. Okay.
Because it was 3 weeks before Kennedy's assassination.
Yeah. It was near the beginning. So I was really only there at most 10 weeks, between 8 weeks and 10 weeks.
In your actual assignment.
Yeah, in the actual assignment.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, because I only lived at that place that long. After the killing of Zim, we were there a little bit longer, and then they insisted that we move out of that.
Really?
That station, because they insisted that it was too insecure. But let me just back up a little bit.
Sure, of course.
In terms of security there, I never was worried about security very mm-hmm. much in Vietnam. But it wasn't long after I was there that they blew up the railroad track, which was just... Here was the house we stayed in, and there was a street maybe 100 yards to the road.
Uh-huh.
And then in the forest there...
Just the other side of the tracks.
Yeah, was the tracks.
Uh-huh. Or I made it up, and they blew it up.
Just blew it up. I mean, and our everything rattled, and it was...
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I kind of went out, listened and watched... All morning, here comes these T-28s diving in and bombing away. And I thought, well, why in the world would they bomb now?
It's long over.
It was my introduction to real war.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was the Mitah thing where I saw the wounded.
Right.
And now here I am, and here comes the Air Force. And they bombed and bombed and bombed, and I thought... Oh, so this is the way it works.
Yep, that's the way it works.
And I thought at the time, isn't this silly? I mean, what's the point in bombing now? It only took... I mean, I'm not a soldier, but I know that if you blow up the railroad track, it only took one or two people, one to put the charge and the other one to push the button, or, you know...
And maybe another one to be a lookout.
Yeah. And there they were, and they did it. And they're long gone.
And they split, you know.
They're long gone. Here, 3-4 hours later, here come the T-28s. Those are those...
Little trainer things.
Yeah. Well, the South Vietnamese Air Force, this was their premier airplane at that period. And so, well, that's...
I guess that's a, but it never occurred to me that the people who set that charge might in fact live on the farm there or be in the community around there, or
they probably were.
But it never occurred to me that any of the Vietnamese who I worked with were somehow the enemy. It just didn't.
It
wasn't in my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting that it wasn't now. But at that time, I just never thought. The only place that we were instructed and where I thought there might be an enemy, William, oh, dangerous out there. Over there, oh, it's very dangerous there. Okay. And don't go down this road at certain, you know, and then we weren't supposed to go to Swin Loc during the night, and we're supposed to travel anywhere during the night, and okay. So that's that was my introduction. But to me, the Viet Cong never were a personalized enemy. I never had a war with them.
Mm-hmm.
Not at the beginning, not in the middle, and not at the end. And that then it was sometime in that fall. I still remember Major Hayden, and we would go into Swin Loc, and those MACV guys. I was told you got to get along with them. Okay, somebody told me. I don't know. It wasn't Don, but so.
Yeah, no, I don't think it was.
Well, I'd never been around the military before, you know.
That's right. You're a sheltered Mennonite boy,
yeah.
You know.
And I didn't know the difference between a major and a sergeant.
Uh huh.
And
the sergeants got more clout.
Yeah, I soon figured out that they had good food, that they had some resources, they had movies.
Mm-hmm.
And there were good ones and bad ones. That's what I figured out. Now, that's very simplistic, but I'm just telling you that there were those who, if you could get to the side, you would learn something from them.
Mm-hmm.
Not very much about Vietnam, but you would learn something from them about something that's interesting to talk about. Mm-hmm. I didn't spend a lot of time there, but they had the movies, and particularly a black sergeant I got to know, and I remember I said, well, now what does that thing mean in your sleeve there? Well, it means I'm a master sergeant. I said, well, does that mean you're going to be a lieutenant pretty soon, or
That would be a demotion for him.
let me explain some things to you. I says, well, you're going to have to explain everything to me. And then he said to me, he gave me my lessons about how this thing worked. We have commissioned officers and non-commissioned officers. And then he said, now, I'm the non-commissioned officer, and I'm the one that make things run around here. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he said, now, you also need to know that I order things. And if you need anything at all, I'll get it for you.
Yes, he will.
And
you don't go to the lieutenant for that.
Well, he gave me good lessons. I never really exploited it in any inappropriate way, but I learned that he'll produce anything that I ask him for.
Mm-hmm.
Not the major, not the captains.
No.
But he could do it.
Yeah.
Well, that was my...
He's the genie you rub, and then poof.
They had
appear.
Magic. I also recognized that when I'd go there, they sort of looked upon us as these brave, unique, humanitarian workers, and how important it was that we were there and so forth.
You saw yourself as that?
No, they sort
thought
of,
you
they,
of that.
They conveyed that to us. When I first got, the group that was there when I first got there, had either orders or because of the personality that he was very interested in relating to people like us. Then he got tough after, and I can't remember, 2 or 3 months, and he insisted that we have Thompson submachine guns in our house.
Uh-huh.
Well,
this was that major you were talking
about?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, here's moral crisis number one for Gene Stoltzfus. I says, well, I'm a pacifist. I'm not going to blow anybody's brains out. What? No, you just have to have it there. Well, this guy, Bill Kruger, he thought it was maybe a good idea to have it. Oh, man, I didn't want to have that thing there, and I didn't want to have a confrontation with him, and I didn't. So I said, Bill, okay, I don't really want this thing. If you want it, you can have it. That's your business. And he made us take two of these Thompson submachine guns and a whole bunch of these, you know, where they put the bullets in.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I still remember that thing. I kind of carried it like... and I wouldn't touch it. You must understand, I came from a home where we didn't hunt.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't play with guns.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you go through in your development sometime when you would like to play with guns. It would be fun to play with guns, but that wasn't part of mine. Anyway, so I kind of negotiated my way through that business, and I learned through that period to stand up to these folks a little bit more and just say no.
Mm-hmm.
But at first I didn't really know how to say no. They were really the only other Americans in the area. Really the only other ones.
No missionaries or anything like that?
I really don't remember other missionaries. I think there may have been a sister or two that I... You see, up the road towards Delat was where a lot of the...
The French and the Catholics.
That's
were,
right.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of French plantation people. They had no interest in relating to people like us. They thought the Americans were
gauche.
Yeah. So
not Bosch, gauche.
Yeah. So I mean, that was okay with me. I'd kind of drive through, and it was interesting to see the rhythm of a plantation and the planting and harvesting and so on.
Just run out of time.
There we are.
Okay.
Okay, so now we got the guns there. And next crisis was the coup itself.
Uh-huh.
And we were all told to stay home and not leave. I remember the majors came out and told us to stay there and don't move. As a matter of fact, they may have even forced us to come with them.
To their camp or
something? Yeah.
Yeah.
They couldn't force us, but it seems to me there was one time, and I think it was then. And then there was the coup. I mean, I thought, wow, I am at the center of history.
Oh, yes.
I am the middle of where it's happening. And I
yes,
still remember going over to the chief of the educational service the next week to talk this over and have a discussion. And I noticed President Zim's picture up there in his office. Yeah, and I said, why is that up there? He said, oh, it goes down right now. By that time, I'm sure he always thought I was some sort of an agent of some kind.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, that's just a tiny chapter, but it was shortly after that that they made such a commotion about us staying out there at that agricultural station that we ended up moving in town. Into Swinlop, which is not a big town. It's a small, mm-hmm. small. It was one of the smallest provincial capitals. It was really carved into becoming a provincial capital at the time that the two Vietnams were divided, and Long Khanh Province was set up. The first year I was in Vietnam, I was in Swinlop, and that was a marvelous, marvelous time because that was. I basically had very little time with anyone but the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I was forced to learn Vietnamese. I was forced to have Vietnamese teachers. I was, you know, where you teach a little English and they teach mm-hmm. a little of that. I tried to make sense out of this assignment we had with the Vietnamese educational program. I didn't personally think I knew an awful lot about how education got done. I'd never taken an education course. But I tried to act like I knew something. We were supposed to make sure the buildings got built, and so we'd go look and see if they were built or not, and to see if the cement was pilfered or the roofing was put on right, and those kinds of things. And then it took me some time to figure out that the money went really to the province chief,
Uh-huh.
And then from the province chiefs to the district chief, and then there was a contractual arrangements, and there were all kinds of kickbacks. So I kind of learned that the person in charge of the educational service was sort of a minor player in this larger thing of how it got. I mean, you have these ministries, but the people who controlled the money were the district and the province chiefs.
Yeah, and they were the...
Yeah, but it took me a while to figure that out. And and I noticed that some places got done and some didn't. Some districts got done and some didn't. Pretty soon the nuns from these Catholic villages began to show up at my house and ask for help in this, and ask for, they'd try to figure out what I had that they could use, you know, and if they thought I had something, they'd ask for it. I ended up spending time in some of those Catholic villages. I enjoyed being with those people. We always...
Were these refugees who had come from the north?
That's right, in 1954. So they were just getting themselves established. They were actually doing quite well by then.
Yeah, by that time, yeah. Yeah. Almost a decade.
Mm-hmm. And, but I began to discover that some of the buildings that got built weren't built very well, and then the teachers had to be trained, and so I kind of try to make sure that happened. I felt like sometimes we were more of an inspector than a facilitator. I didn't feel entirely comfortable with that role, you know.
Being an inspector general,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah, I didn't care for that.
But you had to check.
Yeah, and so I tried to do the job that we were sent there to do, and yeah, tried to...
Because some of the construction might have been shoddy.
Yeah, but I also felt like John Summer did a lot more in terms of working with teachers and helping to train them, and I think that some of the other folks maybe did a little bit more than I did.
Well, somebody told you even kicked down a wall.
Where did I do that? Yeah, I did that.
Yeah.
The wall? I kicked it and it just fell through.
Yeah.
I remember, yeah, a couple places.
Were you demonstrating how shoddy it was?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
You
know? Yeah, I did. I forgot that. It's true. I did.
Actually, Willie Meyer told me that.
It was a mess. But,
This was part of the
district chiefs, you know, they'd have their buddies, a couple buddies who were, and their only way to get money was to, you know, and...
give a little here, give a little there.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
But I, of course, I was pretty devoted to honesty, and I didn't even know how dishonest the system here was at that time, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I used to go in and... I'd talk to the district chiefs were captains, usually, in the South Vietnamese Army.
Uh-huh.
Which meant that they got there because they were favorites of the province chief, who got there who were favorites of either the Diem system or General Kine, who followed, or Key, or
Minh,
you know,
or whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And
would they change with each general?
They would often change, but it'd take a while to get everything changed down at the grassroots level.
Yeah. So it would eventually shake itself out.
Mm-hmm.
So people would be coming in so quickly, or no, perhaps for such a short period of time, as the revolving door went on, then corruption might have become worse.
Particularly when that revolving door in 63, 64, when things were changing fast.
Yeah.
And the strong men were changing.
After Diem's...
After Diem, then you had Minh, and then you had Kine, I believe. I can't even remember them all. But anyway,
yeah.
The changes moving up and down in the military system and in the province chief and district chief level, they wouldn't even get done before the next
one was over. So you would have someone who was loyal to Minh who had skipped Khan, and then it was on to somebody else. Yeah.
And the power dynamics, again, for this little Mennonite boy were so sort of funny, because the major would go in and see the major, who was the province chief, you know, and he'd try to, as they say, kick ass a little bit. And
Yeah, sure.
Well, I didn't want to go in his coattails.
No.
And
it would be a very cool reception.
It's a. So anyway, this business of how you get things done was all involved again with the military business. And after I moved to Swinlock, I discovered that every night about 10 o'clock, they pour howitzer shells into the air and out they'd go.
Uh-huh.
One right after, from about 10, sometimes you'd go to 12. Sometimes they'd go to 11. So once again, here's the war.
Just yeah.
And I remember asking several times, do they have a target or is there something? You know. My friends, my Vietnamese friends, in that part, in that time in Bowling, I don't know if it was because of the assignment or what, but I came to see myself in terms of my own income and sort of my own objectives is sort of on the same level as Vietnamese teachers.
Uh-huh.
So I tried to make relationships with Vietnamese teachers and build connections that way. And that was with the kind of people who were outside of this power structure. And so that's where I really spent my time.
Uh-huh.
And they would come over to the house or we'd get to know each other and so on and so forth. It was a good period. And that was just, it was just in that year, 63-64, that USAID began to set up provincial representatives and send people out to these areas. And so...
So in other words, before that, AID had a more hands-off approach?
Well, they may have been more hands-on, but they had only their... someone who floated in and out of the province, you know, and tried to get things done, and didn't have what later came to be their provincial staff, which in some provinces developed into quite a elaborate body of people, just at the provincial level. We're not talking at the Corps level, we're talking at the provincial level. Civilian staff. And occasionally, as you know, military people were borrowed by aid and put into those positions.
Like Van.
Yeah, like Van and so forth. Although, did you read the book, Van? I probably should get off
it. Parts.
I found it very interesting.
How come?
See, there's always a piece in those crazy guys that I liked. And that was the piece that respected the Vietnamese and listened more. And that, I think, he was a very dangerous person. Ultimately, his loyalties were with the U.S.
Of course.
It was he was in the Lansdale tradition.
Yeah.
And I always tried to listen to those folks, not because I trusted them completely.
Oh, no, 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 no.
But, I mean, but it's not even a no, 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 because in that period, we were learning completely without any framework who could be trusted and who couldn't be trusted.
And to what degree?
Every person was a new. You know, we didn't have a framework for this.
Right.
We didn't think, well, is he political section? Is he CIA? Is he this or that? It was all. Is he nice to the Vietnamese?
Uh-huh.
Has he at least tried to learn, or she tried to learn a little bit of Vietnamese? Do they have time to talk? Or are they always running somewhere else in the world to be with their family? You know, which is probably a good thing, but it's, and sometimes, and also did they, you know, I'm not a moralist, but I didn't like those who really screwed around a lot. I mean, I felt like it was really degrading to them.
You mean sexually?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really, it was very low class.
Yeah.
Some of them. Not all of them, but some of them.
Yeah.
And there was no discipline.
Mm-hmm.
In the military you expect some things, but with the civilians you expect a little bit better. Anyway, so, well, you got me off track on that, but...
You got yourself off. but it was a good off track.
I learned that there was a genuine difference in the U.S. Embassy and in USAID. There were people who had a political framework and with whom you could speak and you could learn something and you could push this button and so forth, and there were those...
It's not so interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I realized...
That you just waste your time with the other ones.
Yeah. Okay. I mean that's not new, but I mean I realize now that I did have a sort of a political orientation that mm-hmm. I didn't go to Vietnam understanding myself that way. But I realized that you know, growing up in the environment where I grew up, where there were people coming who were all kinds.
Yeah.
into our home, I was listening to this and I saw how the world worked, and now I was making it work too.
Yeah.
And I was actually in that period already pretty appalled by the incompetence of the U.S. Armed Forces. I just thought, these guys are crazy. They don't have... And then I still remember the day the major, there was a new major called Hayden, Major Hayden.
Hey, I went out in a helicopter and I shot me a VC. Shot the motherfucker right like that, you know.
And, I mean, that... And I'd go off and I'd think about this and I'd think... What? Did he really shoot anybody? And if he did, what good did it do? Or what... You know, if there is a war... What?
How did he know it was a VC?
It just was... It was just so different than my experience of Vietnam.
Yeah. You know,
it was just so different. And then I learned, also already at that period, there were American military people who didn't follow that line of thinking, who were trying to learn,
uh-huh.
and were already being critical at that time.
Really, even by 63, 64?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, and they'd have their favorites. They'd talk about Colonel Whoop-de-Doo coming or General somebody else coming. I remember I watched a couple of those. This kind of crap going on.
All the salutes. Yes,
I was. I just kind of laughed. I thought, what a game this is. Anyway, after... 63, 64, the summer, what we would call here the summer of 64. I then transferred. The program had gone about as far as it could go in terms of Hamlet development there in Xuân Lộc, and then I transferred to Nha Trang and worked in the same program
mm-hmm.
up there in the Khánh Hòa province, and I also taught some English at a little technical school.
Okay.
And it was that fall. Let's see, Tonkin Gulf was... When was Tonkin Gulf? No, that would have been early 65. I wish I had my exact dates in front of me, but it was a new experience getting involved in Nha Trang, because by now I know Vietnam. And I moved very quickly into a natural relationship, and that's a big city. And I literally had almost nothing to do with the American presence there. I can't even remember once going to a movie there or going to their little store or whatever. In those days, I think they had a presence of some 40 or 50 people.
In Nha Trang.
Yeah, in Nha Trang. Have you been in Vietnam? Nha Trang is an absolutely gorgeous city. Anyway, after Tonkin Gulf, the Marines hit Da Nang, and then there's this massive influx of troops into Nha Trang. And it changed everything, you know. 40,000 troops overnight. And I remember those troops that came. They reported that they had venereal disease more than 100% a month.
And a Vietnamese doctor, Dr. Tocker, and I, he came to me and he said, "Gene, we got to do something about this. This is infecting Vietnam. So you and I," this is what he said to me, he says, "I'll tell you what, you and I, we're going to make the Vietnamese Health Association. I'm president and you're vice president."
Okay. Okay.
"And we get to go around and we can say this bar is acceptable and this bar isn't."
Uh-huh.
I said, "Okay, sounds good enough to me."
Yeah.
"Let's go." So basically he closed down a bunch of bars and pressure built and it was cleaned up some. I mean, it was never like it should have been. It was still a dirty mess, but it moved from being a pig pen to a, you know, at least a strip. And that was sort of an interesting sidelight. And by that time, I was spending more time out in the villages if I could.
Uh-huh.
There was...
Again, with the Hamlet School programs.
Yeah, and there was a lot of gossipy pressure that Americans should not travel. And there was a lot of warning that we shouldn't travel down to Phan Rang, which was the next province to the south, or up to Bamatut, which you go up the coast
up
and...
Up and over.
Yeah, and so, but in general, that was a very important informative period for me there in Nha Trang. I needed a little larger environment to grow, and I got to know a lot of Vietnamese. I got to know Vietnamese merchants. I taught, there was something called the Vietnamese American Association in Nha Trang, and that was put together by the USIA. And they had their own goals and so forth there, I know. But I taught some classes there, and that was a place to meet a lot of Vietnamese.
Uh-huh.
That was just an extra volunteer, one or two evenings a week.
Uh-huh.
And then I would teach a little bit in the high school. Again, extra. I did a lot of extra things besides the Hamlet education thing. I remember I was on a committee to collect emergency relief, made up, it was sort of led by the Buddhists there, but they wanted me to be the treasurer because they wouldn't trust each other. It had the Catholics and the Buddhists and a couple other groups. I don't even remember who all was part of it.
Uh-huh.
So I was the treasurer of that group. So, I mean, this sort of business of coalition work was already beginning to grow in me.
Uh-huh.
In the way that now I do it as a matter of course.
Or instinct.
Yeah. Anyway, the other thing about that period was a growing awareness that the whole history of Vietnam was now about to be changed by this war. There wasn't much that I felt we could do to change this. And I was particularly struck, continued to be struck, by how little American soldiers knew about Vietnam. And I had a peculiar set of experiences where the a series of young lieutenants who were recent graduates of West Point were assigned there in fairly, you know, and the Army kind of quivers a little when a West Pointer shows up, because it's, particularly if the commanding officers made it up, you know, that's sort of like, that was at least my sense.
That there was one of their boys who was just coming in, he's going to be the fair-haired child.
Yeah,
would,
especially the ones that went to West Point.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I...
Yeah, and these folks come in and they had no idea what they were getting into. They didn't even know who to talk to.
And you've been there less than a year.
I knew lots more, and I learned that I had to be careful what I say around them, because they might take what I said and make it into a central
method of interpreting everything.
Yeah, and so I learned that you just had to be careful, and I didn't say much to them. Another level of interaction is that I decided to try to work with the chaplains, because I had a background in seminary and so forth.
Right.
So I thought, well, I could get some delivery of either service or some correctional things in terms of behavior, those sorts of things, through the chaplains. I didn't get much from there.
They wouldn't help?
They talked, but they were basically sacramental machines. And
sacramental machines, that's interesting. It's an interesting phraseology.
Well, it is a little bit cynical. But
yeah,
I really do have respect for chaplains in the Army, even today, who try to do a job that has integrity. I think that's not easy for them, even though they are majors or captains.
I'm sure you're right, but I'm thinking about all the stuff they have
but
to
I couldn't
doing.
Find the good ones. I know there were good ones there, but I couldn't find them.
Uh-huh.
And so that was a little discouraging. During this period, of course, we were in IBS, we were questioning the thing. And I still had not passed any watershed.
Yeah. Let me ask you to back up just a bit to something that you said before, and that was concerning the entrance of AID in a more thorough way down deeper in the countryside. Why do you think they were starting to do this by 1964? Why hadn't they done it before? Why are they doing it now?
I think the orders came from Washington.
Okay.
I think the end of Zim, this is my interpretation, the end of Zim provided a window of opportunity that they thought might lead to positive influence on the Vietnamese government system.
Okay.
That was frittered away. In fact, in my interpretation of that history all the way up to 75, if they would have learned from their mistakes and the limits of American ability, even in that short window of opportunity after the end of Zim, they would not pursue this policy of endless increased deployment. But they didn't learn that, and they never did learn very much about talking to Vietnamese, and they never did learn very much from Vietnam. And I would even argue that Americans of that particular era probably couldn't have learned from Vietnam.
Yeah.
I think the Vietnamese probably were too smart. I think they were.
Yeah, though.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that they were always smart among themselves.
No.
It doesn't mean that they were always honest.
Of course.
But they were smart.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm wondering if you did point out something that I was kind of thinking, that the orders did come from higher up, and they did come in response to the Diem assassination.
The frustration that followed that, which was sort of inability to put together any tape together, any kind of meaningful direction in the General Ming.
Yeah. That General Big Min?
Yeah, Big Min.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So that, let me just pause this for a moment just to tell you what another person who was in country at the same time said.
No, I think at that point,
in 64, after
Diem's, they decided to try to spoon feed this thing all up and down the line, so that somebody was. We could go inside, incidentally. If the rain bothers you?
It doesn't bother me.
I'm fine too.
I'm just getting out the next tape because we're almost done with this one.
They decided they have to have somebody with clout out there to hound those district chiefs,
hound those service chiefs and hound the province chief. Now, it must have been enormously confusing for the Vietnamese. Here come this set of MACV advisors, the military advisors on one side, with their whole club and so forth. And by end of 64, 65, that crowd always had 20 people at a minimum.
Uh-huh.
20, you know, all of the servants, the privates and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind
to
of,
do the typing and
to do
and
the
stuff.
Junk work, and then the officers to drink.
Yeah.
And yeah. They didn't have anything to do except take care of the jeeps and run around and try to push the Vietnamese around. That's the only thing they did.
Uh-huh.
And then the civilians... Now, the civilians didn't have big offices. I mean, they were fairly modest. And some of those USAID guys were former IVSers, you know.
Especially as time went on.
Especially as time went on. And they came, there was only one of them at the beginning, and then it grew to two, and then it grew to... Then they'd have public safety, and then they'd agriculture and refugee, and it grew to... By 67, they'd have six or seven people in some of those provinces, I know. But that came not because they asked the Vietnamese. That came as an order, and it was an order, I'm convinced it was an order to both develop, to spoon feed it at the grassroots level, meaning at the province and a little bit the district, but primarily the province level, and to push the military agenda, so both of those were strengthened.
Already the idea of the courts was beginning to emerge even before the organizational structure is really
right.
Firmed up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that would seem to make sense.
Yeah.
In terms of just bureaucratic evolution.
Yeah. And see, I think what was happening in the U.S. with the U.S. policy people was, it's the same thing that happens to people like me. Now I'm responsible for programs. Do a program, doesn't work. Now, do you fiddle with it and try to make it work, or do you pull the plug and take the heat?
Yeah, right.
And nobody was willing to pull the plug and take the heat.
Mm-hmm.
And it just rolled on. It got bigger and bigger and bigger, and they couldn't get it done. It's just a classical example of making a small problem into a medium-sized problem into a big problem. That just, the bigger it gets, the bigger the fall.
Yeah, yeah. I always think of it as like taking a piece of dry meat and trying to chew it, and it keeps on expanding in your mouth until it's beginning to choke you.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I did want to go over that again, because it's a concern of mine, you know, as to when things begin to evolve. I mean, was there, well, of course, you were working in the education. Whoops, I think this is about...